for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm, bird specialist. Tim Gallagher trekked deep into the remote Sierra Madre Mountains of northwestern Mexico to find a long-lost giant woodpecker. During his dangerous quest, he uncovered the only images ever taken of a living imperial woodpecker. When the Cornell Lab of Ornithology released the 1956 footage, it drew more than 100,000 viewers in 3 days. Gallagher's new book is Imperial Dreams, Tracking the Imperial Woodpecker Through the Wild Sierra Madre. Tim Gallagher joins me here in the studio. And of course, I know there are many, many bird lovers in our listening area. Do call us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you, Tim. It's good to see you.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be here.
Last time you and I talked, you were looking for another kind of woodpecker.
Yes, I was looking for the ivory-billed woodpecker, a bird of the American South, and it's actually the closest relative of the imperial woodpecker, although the imperial woodpecker in Mexico is much larger. It's almost a third larger.
So what set you off on a journey to find a woodpecker that many believe is extinct?
Well, I was interested in both species going back. So, you know, when I went looking through the South, I was actually, what I had in mind was something more like an oral history project where I'd find everyone who'd seen the ivory-billed woodpecker in the 1930s and, you know, early 40s. And I, you know, record their thoughts and ask them questions about the bird, because if it indeed was extinct, then these would be the last living contact we have with these birds. And I wanted to glean all the knowledge I could from them. And that's what led ultimately, you know, I heard about someone who'd had a sighting only a week, 6 days earlier, Gene Sparling, in an Arkansas bayou. And my friend Bobby Harrison and I went down there, and we were going to spend a week floating the bayou, and we actually had a sighting on the second day. And it was crazy. It was literally flew right in front of us, and it was swinging up to land on a tree.
And you were positive of what you saw.
Absolutely positive. I mean, it was unmistakable, and we yelled ivory-billed, and of course scared the bird, and we went off running through the woods, ripping our clothes, climbing over fallen logs, almost going into cardiac.
To catch another glimpse.
And Bobby was crying. Oh, an ivory-billed woodpecker.
Oh, my gosh. So then you go after this other imperial woodpecker.
Yeah, well, at the time, even back then, I was interviewing people I could find who'd been on expeditions searching for the bird, like in the 1940s and 1970s. And so I was already very much interested in it, and actually got distracted by finding that bird in Arkansas, because
right.
Then that was the whole story. We just chased after that bird. So after that died down, I turned my focus to Mexico again. But meanwhile, it was getting more and more dangerous all the time there. And some of my Mexican friends would say, well, better not go this year. It's bad. It's very dangerous. Wait till next year. Maybe it'll be better. And then every year it'd be 10 or 15 times more dangerous. And I finally decided I really have to go now. If there are any of these birds left, it's imperative to find them and try to help them.
Let's talk for a moment about this 1956 footage of the imperial woodpecker. We now have that on our website, wamu.org. So for those of you who'd like to see the bird we're talking about, you can go to that website now. Describe this imperial woodpecker.
Well, it's 2 feet in length. It's black and white, and it's almost got a bluish sheen to it on the black, and then it's like a white triangle below where the bird's flight feathers are white, and they have a beautiful crest. The male has red on his crest. The female has a black crest, but it sort of curves forward much more on her. And she's a real impressive-looking bird. And that's what we have in that film.
And that's what you have, a drawing on the cover of your book titled Imperial Dreams. And this artist rendering is really smashing-looking. But tell me about that 1956 footage, where that came from, who got it.
Well, this is a kind of a funny and interesting story. There's this dentist in Pennsylvania called William Ryan, and, you know, he and his wife didn't have any children, so they had lots of money to spend, but he got in his head, he really wanted to take the first sound recordings and films footage of an imperial woodpecker. So he launched three separate expeditions in 1953, 1954, and 1956. And, you know, really roughing it. And I don't know why he left the good life to do that, although I do personally understand it. But, you know, these guys were all World War II combat veterans, and, you know, maybe they just felt like it was a good adventure. And they had some wild times down there, you know, even back then. It was really like going into the 1900s, I mean, the 1800s. So,
but they did.
On the third time. Yeah, and they didn't get any sound recordings. This bird has never had sound recordings. They had to carry this huge parabolic microphone on the back of a mule. It looks almost like a sledding disc. And it took six truck batteries to operate the recording unit. So that was hopeless. But he did manage to get, on the 1956 trip, he did manage to take some footage from the back of a mule of a female imperial that kept flying around from tree to tree and foraging. But then the funny part of it was, he was such a perfectionist and sort of a professional level photographer and cinematographer, that he was embarrassed by it. He didn't show it to anyone because, you know, he wanted it to be rock solid on a tripod, and of course he just couldn't accomplish it. And so this just
so he was
forgotten.
Embarrassed by the film he got.
Yeah.
So he put it away.
Right, right.
And how did you get hold of it?
Well, my colleague Marchand Lamertink, he was looking through some old letters in the Cornell archives. And James Tanner, the ivory-billed woodpecker researcher from the 1930s and 40s, he'd been planning to go after the imperial himself, and he had contacted Ryan because he knew a lot about it. And Ryan happened to mention in one sentence that, you know, he'd taken some films of the bird down there. And so Marchand tracked him down on one of his trips, and they actually, and he didn't know what it would look like. He came all the way from Holland and found this guy, and they put the 16-millimeter projector on, and he had the sense of mind to have a tape recorder running. And that's the voiceover that you hear when the movie plays is William Ryan and his wife and Marchand sitting together in the living room watching this movie. And even then, William Ryan is saying how terrible it is. You know, that was lousy footage, you know.
But, you know, Tim, you said many people don't understand why a dentist would leave his lucrative practice to go out and look for a bird. I think there are many people who don't understand the mentality of bird watchers and bird seekers. Now, you need to help us understand through your own thinking and your own passion for this subject what it's all about.
Yeah, I know it is hard to explain to someone who doesn't care about birds or that kind of thing. And I'm really not the kind who will just do a lot of work just to get another bird on my life list that I've never seen before. But I focus intensely on particular species that I'm really, really interested in. You know, like the peregrine falcon, I was really interested in that when they were, you know, endangered and in danger of becoming extinct. And I think I turned to the ivory-billed woodpecker and the imperial because they're very beautiful, dramatic-looking birds. But they also, you know, there is a poignant story behind them. One of the most unique, really birds in North America was the ivory-billed woodpecker, and we just destroyed its habitat and devastated the bird's population. And I wanted to study this bird. I wanted to find out everything I could about it. And if possible, if everything went right, to find a nest and help protect them.
Rescue it,
yes. And I felt the same way about the Imperial. And it had an additional poignancy because it had never been studied much in its life. I mean, just the fact that no pictures and sound recordings had ever been made of it. And even though this mountain range, the Sierra Madre Occidental, it starts like 50 miles south of the U.S. border, but for some reason we didn't, our ornithologist didn't invest the time and effort to track this bird down and learn more about it.
And of course, you set off to do exactly that, even knowing that it was likely extinct already.
But I did have that additional thing keeping me going, that I knew there'd be people there who remembered the bird, and I wanted to talk to them about it. What was it like? What was its voice like? What can you tell me about how it lived? And that was wonderful. Finding, you know, people in their 80s, 90s, even I interviewed a 99-year-old man on his deathbed and who, you know, told me about back in 1919,
and seeing
when he was
bird.
A kid. Yes, yes. And
Tim Gallagher, his new book is titled Imperial Dreams, Tracking the Imperial Woodpecker Through the Wild Sierra Madre. Short break here. We'll be right back. And if you've just joined us, Tim Gallagher is my guest. He's editor-in-chief of Living Bird, the magazine of the world-famous Cornell Lab of Ornithology. His new book is titled Imperial Dreams, Tracking the Imperial Woodpecker Through the Wild Sierra Madre. And just before the break, you were talking about having talked with a 90-some-year-old man who can remember seeing this beautiful bird. How did he describe his own experience?
Well, this guy was amazing anyway. He can remember as a very young child, like having to hide when Pancho Villa's raiders were sweeping through the area. But he remembered this winter of 1919 when people were getting that Spanish flu and a lot of entire families died. And he told me about that. And he said, and it was also they had the most snowfall they'd ever had in the village of Creel that anyone can remember before or since. And it pushed these birds down from the higher country. And that's when he first saw them. They were actually right in the village of Creel. They'd see Imperial woodpeckers.
And probably in a fair number of them at one time.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Sometimes these were seen in groups of 10 or 11 or, you know, a dozen.
And, so the question is, why did it disappear?
You know, the belief has always been among scientists that they were collateral damage caught because of the logging. People, you know, loggers would come in, and not only would they cut down a lot of this. These were only found in the high country, mesa pine forests, you know, old growth forests. So not only they'd come in there and cut the trees down, but they'd also open up the area to other people, you know, people, subsistence hunters and people like that. And people thought, well, they probably came in with 22s and shot them for food and other birds. And I always had a little bit of a problem with that because I wondered, well, why shoot them when there are other things to shoot, like a squirrel or
shooting
whatever?
Shooting that right, bird right. for food?
Right, but the more I looked around and interviewed people, I started hearing stories about, in 1952, they killed 12 of these birds near this one village. And then I talked to a man who in the mid-1950s remembers riding past a sawmill and seeing six of them piled up. And then, but the kicker for me was on our last expedition when we were interviewing this man, and this elderly man, and he told us, in about 1953 or 1954, a logging company had said, you know, someone, a representative from them had said, these birds are destroying valuable timber and we have to do something about it. We need to kill them off. And even though, of course, these birds were only attacking trees that were all full of grubs and wasn't good lumber anyway, but this man said that he gave them poison to smear on their foraging trees, and that these birds would come in and get it on their bills and ingest it and die. And that's when all my hopes kind of came cascading down, because I realized, well, these birds moved around in roving bands and things and covered a lot of ground. You wouldn't just wipe out that local population.
Right.
They could be coming off some distant mesa and, you know, where they would have been safe otherwise. And I realized there was an extermination campaign waged against these birds. I mean, I know it's circumstantial evidence, but I had interviewed people in several different parts of the Sierra, hundreds of miles apart, and I was getting a similar story. And it all happened in the 50s.
So now, as I understand it, nearly 50,000 people have been killed in that whole area of Mexico, where you were since 2006 in the drug war, and the death toll keeps rising. So your friends were warning you. You kept putting off your trip, putting it off, and finally you went. It's always been kind of a hideout for outlaws from Geronimo to Pancho Villa. So how were you able to stay safe?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, I almost felt like I was always missing having something terrible happen. I'd go somewhere and then, I camped out behind that rancher, Meredith Romney, who in fact is one of Mitt Romney's Mexican cousins, but
because his father George Romney was
right,
born
yeah,
in Mexico.
Right, right, and most of the Mexican Mormons fled from Mexico when the Mexican Revolution was at its height, and then a lot of them went back, but some didn't. So Mitt Romney's branch of the family stayed in the U.S., and Meredith's Romney's family moved back to Mexico. So he's a fairly big rancher down there. And he was the man I was traveling with knew him quite well, and he let us camp out on his ranch. And just about 2 weeks later, he was kidnapped and held for ransom in a cave up in the mountains. And they held him for a couple of days, and his they had to set it up so his brother got some ransom money and was supposed to throw it out in a bag on the street in the middle of the night, and they'd let him go after that. And they did. They did let him go up in the mountains. And my friend and some other people had to search for him, and they found him the next day about noon. But it turned out later they did finally catch those kidnappers, and they had kidnapped 18 different people, and 14 of them had been killed. Some of them after paying the ransom. So Meredith was very lucky. So that was one thing where I just felt like I just missed that. That's good.
But when you realized how close you were to that kind of danger, did it at all dissuade you from continuing your search?
Well, I mean, in a way, it was weird. I was so committed to it by then, and I'd almost get an adrenaline rush too. I mean, to tell you the truth, it's like, whoa, I got to do this now quickly, and I really wanted to go to these areas fast because it was just getting worse by the minute, and even. You know, I'd start thinking, you travel around in those mountains, you think, well, this isn't too bad. I mean, really terrible, rough roads. Takes you 5 hours to get 20 miles. But you think the people are so nice you meet up there, the Tepehuan Indians and Tarahumaras, and very nice people give you the shirt off their back.
But then you run
into these guys with their club cab pickups with dark windows holding AK-47s. And
did you see them
as
well?
I did, yeah.
And you just kept walking?
This was the very last trip. And actually, my wife read my field notes when I got back from that. She said, no more, please.
Enough already.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. That was just insane.
Let's talk about the treasure map that your friend gave you on his deathbed to help you find that bird.
Yeah, this is David Allen, who is the son of the famous Cornell ornithologist Arthur Allen, who actually founded the Cornell Lab of Ornithology where I work. And I when I moved here about 23 years ago, I got to know David. And we became pretty good friends. We were both fly fishermen, and we did other things like that. But he had been really obsessed with the imperial woodpecker, and he and his father and his mother, they all went in 1946 all over those mountains, and they actually found one, but they weren't able to photograph it. So he came back again in 1971. And then just when he got back, he was sent... this Bernardo Villa, famous biologist in Mexico, he sent him this map that some of his graduate students had made, and they said they had seen imperial woodpeckers, and you know, it's like he made these red zebra stripes in the area where they were nesting, and he wanted to go back there, but he wasn't able to get funding for it, and it was something he never got to do, and he just, not that long before he died, he gave me this map, and he said, I sure would like to go along with you and do this. And this was in the Copper Canyon area up in the high country there. And I did get to go there. And parts there have become really bad drug country, too. We drove out to one area we were checking that was one of the places that was in this territory. And we found an airplane landing strip that had been cut there, obviously, to get drugs in and out. And so we got out of there quickly.
Yeah, I was about to say... what kind of vehicle were you traveling in?
We were in a four-wheel drive.
A Jeep or something like that?
Yeah.
I can't imagine that a four-wheel Jeep with men driving along would not attract the attention of these people who are certainly potential kidnappers.
Yeah.
And I guess the question becomes, are you crazy?
Well, people have said that.
Yeah. You know, you have to wonder, moving into that kind of area with that passion driving you, and what it is inside that drives you.
Yeah. Well, like I said, the last trip, that was the one where, you know, we actually we'd made friends with someone who was a forester, and he knew some people living in this remote village. It was actually where that movie was taken. And we wanted to go back there because we looked on Google Earth and we'd seen these beautiful mesas that had never been logged.
And
which you could see.
Rock formation.
Yeah, yeah, with cliffs around them that you couldn't, you know, so it was impractical for people to log them. And we just thought, well, these are these lost worlds we've been looking for where maybe these birds could still exist. So we really wanted to get out there. And I had found this man, Richard Heintzelman, who was the last remaining survivor of that 1956 expedition. And we're trying to figure out where exactly this film was taken. He said, well, there's this big rock there. And he showed me pictures of it. And he said, if you can find that rock, that's within a half a mile of where the movie was taken. And so anyway, this forester arranged a meeting with these villagers who actually were drug growers. But, you know, he thought, you've really got to get some allies in this. And so they came down, and he gave them this impassioned speech, kind of, well, you really should help these guys. They just want to come down here for the good of Mexico and help us with their wild. And they said, oh, yeah, yeah. And they're really great about it. And so we showed them those pictures, like those rocks. And I go, oh, see, Los Pilares, the pillars. They knew it. So they knew right where it was. And so we were really excited. And then they were saying they were going to, help us get up there. But there were dangerous areas on the way with other people in control. And then across the river, which we had also wanted to check, it's controlled by Los Zetas, the worst drug cartel. They're paramilitaries who left the Mexican military to become, part of this drug cartel. So we knew this was going to be a scary thing. But then later, that night before we left, the forester got an anonymous phone call from someone who knew what we were doing, kind of threatened us and said,
do not go.
Right, right. So anyway, we're supposed to meet this drug grower in the plaza at midnight and talk to him about it. And our forester friend Julian was there, and Marchon Lamertink was with me. And he just said, well, a real wave of violence is going through here now, and you really probably shouldn't go now. And he said, I know I told you it wasn't that bad about a month ago when you first contacted me, but it's really bad now. And so Marchon asked me if I wanted to go or not, and I just thought, I want to go, yes.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So you proceeded.
Yes, which kind of made it, ever after that on the journey, it was like I felt, boy, if anything happens, it's all my fault. But, I just could not imagine, we knew where that place was. We knew these beautiful, mesas out there that were untouched. And what if there's birds out there? No, I figured it's not going to be better next year. It's going to be 100 times worse. We'll never go back there in my lifetime. And, maybe there are birds there. I just couldn't imagine not going. I was just adamant.
And what did your companions think?
Well, the other Mexican scientist who was going to go with us at that point, he dropped out of the expedition. And but Marchand's very stoical, and she, yeah, we'll go. And But the next day on the way up, it was a five-hour drive on really rough, rugged roads, some areas where you could walk faster than you could drive a vehicle, because just these dirt roads with potholes and boulders. And at one point, and we were following the drug growers who were in front of us, a pickup truck came racing past us, and the guys were carrying AK-47s, and they went up to beside the other guy's car and went beside him for a while, talking to him or something, and then they peeled away. And when we finally got to his friendly territory in his village, he got out of the car, and he was just white as a sheet and shaking. And he'd been so confident the night before that I thought, oh, well, it's going to be okay if he says it's okay. And he immediately went into his cabin, and he got an Uzi and started loading bullets into a clip, and he put it under the seat of his car. And you got to remember, in Mexico, people can't have guns. They, even like a .22 or something, it's against the law. So, they'll take your car away and throw you in jail. So that was a big step. That was an escalation. But he said those people had fit the description of someone who'd killed, some people who'd killed someone in another village just a week earlier. So.
And you continued?
Yes. Well, then we're already past it. And he said, but under no circumstances, try to get out of here without me. I'll meet you in 2 weeks and in this village, and we'll
get... 2 weeks, yeah. In this village trying to get a glimpse of this bird. Mm-hmm. And?
Well, I didn't get a glimpse, but I did have some interesting interviews, including that one of the man who explained what happened with the poison. And but I fell off a cliff. It seemed like suddenly I could have died 10 different ways. And then violence did really break out. You know, some houses were burned on the road down the mountain, and someone was kidnapped from a village and held for ransom. I mean, I'm talking about like an $800 ransom. And it was all these villagers having to put their money together to bail this guy out. So it was crazy.
Tim Gallagher. His new book is titled Imperial Dreams, Tracking the Imperial Woodpecker Through the Wild Sierra Madre. When we come back, it's time to open the phones and hear your thoughts on his journey. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the John A. Hartford Foundation, working to improve the health of older Americans at jhartfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Mad Men. I've been watching this season, and I have so many questions about what's happening to Don Draper and Megan and Don Draper's new mistress. I just got to pose those questions to the creator of Mad Men, Matthew Weiner. We'll feature that interview with Matthew Weiner on the next Fresh Air.
And welcome back. I've been talking this hour with Tim Gallagher. He is an ornithologist. He is the editor-in-chief of Living Bird, the magazine of the world-famous Cornell Lab of Ornithology. His new book, all about the imperial woodpecker, and his experience trying to track that woodpecker throughout the Sierra Madre, is titled Imperial Dreams. There was a film made of the imperial woodpecker back in 1956. The qualities of the film are perhaps not, let's say, 100%, but you can see them at our website, drshow.org. We're going to open the phones now, first to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Diane. How are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you, sir.
Good. Well, I have a two-part question, and I'm not sure if it's all answerable, but we'll give it a shot here. Do we have any kind of postulation about how many imperial and ivory-billed woodpeckers there might be left in the world? And the second part question would be, if there are some left, and we know there's some of the Iberville left, if there's some of the Imperial left, might it be possible with our level of technology now to get DNA samples and start cloning these birds and start a breeding program to release back into the wild? And I'll happily take my answer off the air.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling.
Well, we really don't know, have any idea how many of these birds are left.
Or I mean, if.
Right. Any. I mean, a lot of people think the Iberville and the Imperial woodpeckers are extinct. I mean, I happen to have seen an Iberville woodpecker, you know, 9 years ago. So, you know, hopefully there's a few of those around. But I believe there's probably a handful of Imperial woodpeckers left in Mexico based on, you know, people I interviewed in the field who had good descriptions of birds they'd seen within the last 5 years. So, but whether we can save them or not, I don't know. It was very depressing in Mexico. You know, there's no way the government could protect them, even if we found a nest. As for your other question, I mean, we have specimens, you know, at various museums, and if they ever do develop a way to clone them, you know, based on their DNA, which I don't know if they ever will be. I know a lot of people are talking about it now, but we do have those specimens.
To Saratoga, Florida. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning, Diane. I've always wanted to talk to you.
Well, I'm glad to have you with us.
Well, I'm calling because I raised birds, and I'm half Colombian, and I've been to the Amazon, and as a matter of fact, many years ago, 20-some years ago, I brought back scarlet macaw and a blue and gold that went to the Louisiana and Alabama Zoo for captive breeding programs. I also wrote about the Cornell lab because I was on the wrong side of the drug war, and I, of course, straightened everything up. I was a kid when this happened because I'm on the coast of Florida, but I took my interest in birds, and I used some of the money that was ill-gotten, I guess, but I raised about I don't know how many macaws in Sarasota and in Englewood, actually. And I just want to know from Mr. Gallagher if they are doing more of this captive breeding so that we can re-release. And also, because I was in that, I wrote about it in Handcuffs in the Sand. I wrote that we need to work on something different with this drug war because it is interfering with ecology and everything.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, we don't have any living members of either of these two species in captivity, so we don't have any way to have a captive breeding project right now, but it would be great if we did.
Here's an email from David in Hedgesville, West Virginia. Is there any chance that the bird sighted that was thought to be an ivory bill woodpecker could have been an offspring of pileated woodpeckers that had a genetic change similar to that which started ivory bills in the first place? And that's what you and I talked about 10 years ago.
Well, no, I mean, they're in a different genus, so they're not even closely related. You know, with the ivory bill and imperial are Campephalus woodpeckers and pileated Dryocopus.
Tell me about the similarities in appearance and the differences.
Well, a pileated woodpecker is also a large crested woodpecker, although it's significantly smaller than an ivory-billed woodpecker. And, you know, they fly differently. You know, pileated has kind of a bounding flight, while an ivory-billed woodpecker has really straight, direct flight, almost like a duck. And so it's difficult to mistake them, you know, in the field, I would think, if you get a good look at it like that.
But how come no one else has since then seen an ivory-billed woodpecker?
Well, people have. I mean, even during the Cornell search, we had, I think, 16 different sightings, and we wrote up 7 of them in that science article. And there are still reports coming in that, you know, we're looking at.
All right. And here's an email from Sam, who says, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology has drawers full of ivory-billed study skins. In fact, hundreds of them, collected in the 30s and 40s. I think Cornell is partly responsible for the ivory bill's disappearance. Are your efforts fueled by institutional guilt?
Well, I have to correct that statement a little bit. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology, or the Cornell Museum, has three specimens of the ivory bill woodpecker, and also a couple of mounted ones someone donated to us. And none of them were collected in the 30s and 40s. They were all basically the late 19th century and from Florida. And I think we have one skull of an imperial woodpecker. And and I should point out that Arthur Allen, who founded the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, he would never have collected an ivory bill woodpecker, and he had chances to. He found a pair in 1924, a nesting pair in Florida, and that was when people already thought they were extinct. I mean, this was a big story at the time, like, oh, the ivory bill woodpecker's not extinct. And some people, local taxidermists, read about that in the paper, and they went out and shot the birds.
Oh.
And so then 11 years later, when he was in Louisiana in 1935 filming those ivory-billed woodpeckers, he was very secretive about it. He didn't tell people where he was, and he learned his lesson.
I should
And they, did,
say.
Of course, did not collect any of those birds. So what he said was totally wrong.
To Whitefish Point, Michigan. Good morning, Jonathan.
Hey, good morning, Diane and Tim. It's an honor to talk to you both. I'm actually en route for a weekend of bird watching at Whitefish Point, Michigan.
Good for you.
Yeah, I'm excited. And Tim, I just wanted to thank you for the sense of adventure that your story, both for Ivory Bill and Imperial, brings to our common interest of bird watching. We have 2 million bird watchers here in Michigan, and the average age is about 65. So in my role as director for Michigan Audubon, I'm trying to bring young people into the fold all the time. And these stories are straight out of the pages of Outside Magazine, and that just makes me so happy to hear, and that there's still people charged up about getting out and, despite the threats and the dangers, looking for these imperiled species. So thank you very much, and I'll take comments off the air.
Thanks for calling, Jonathan.
Yeah, well, thank you. I hope we can attract some more birders. We are getting grayer now, and we need some young blood in the activity.
Do you think it is something that people of our age are more interested in than young people generally?
Well, I mean, I've been afraid that as people spend more time, young people spend more time sitting at the computer or using their iPads or, whatever, they're having a virtual life. They're not getting out in nature. And that's the only thing I worry about. You hear about nature deficit disorder, and I think it's real. And I think we do need to get young people to go out more.
So what is the Cornell Ornithology Lab doing to try to promote birding?
Oh, I mean, we have all kinds of programs. We've even got, curricula for schools. You can go, learn more about birds. And we've got our All About Birds website. People can learn about all their local birds and listen to their vocalizations and see pictures of them.
You know what you ought to do? You ought to establish a summer camp for young people who would be your potential new generation of birders.
I know. That would be good. And we do have something like that. It's kind of selective, though. Only about a dozen kids can get in, and they're really... They already kind of have a hardcore commitment, but I could see doing something broader like that and, trying to encourage
it. Something really, really worthwhile for nature in general, but certainly for young people's appreciation of nature and the world. Let's go to College Park, Maryland. Hi, Janine.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
First-time caller, long-time listener.
Oh, good.
And I just wanted to tell Tim, The Grail Bird is one of my favorite books, and I will definitely be going out and buying the new one. Also, do you know Don Messersmith? I know he went on one of the Cornell-sponsored trips, I think, down to the area where the Ivory Bill is.
Yeah, his name's familiar. I can't place his face, though.
He was an entomology professor at the University of Maryland.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And he said he saw one. And if he saw one, I believe him.
I believe him, too.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Janine, to Wichita, Kansas. And Alice, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. This program is of special interest to me because in the early 80s, when my son was in grad school at Cornell, he worked in the ornithology lab. And I remember that one summer he spent, I believe, most of the summer transferring recorded bird sounds by a well-known ornithologist from old celluloid, I think it was, to something that would be preservable. And unfortunately, when he got the project finished, that ornithologist was killed in a plane crash.
Oh, my.
And in my naivete, one day he had said to me, Mom, Cornell has the world's largest collection of bird sounds. And I kind of said, well, so what's the big deal? And he said, oh, Mom, you would be surprised. Biologists, linguists, all kinds of people from all over the world come to study the bird sounds. How does the brain change and all of this? And I remember he also managed a concert hall at Cornell at the same time, and he said, I thought we used delicate instruments to record music, but that's nothing like what it takes to record bird sounds.
Oh, what a lovely comment.
Yeah. Yeah, and the person your son was talking about who was killed in the plane crash was Ted Parker, who's really one of the greatest field biologists of the 20th century, and he recorded the bulk of the recordings we have in the Lab for Ornithology collection.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And speaking of bird sounds, when you were on your search for the imperial woodpecker, you had something that tried to imitate the sound. You assumed or thought that woodpecker would make. How did you do that?
Well, most woodpeckers in the Campephalus genus have a real distinctive drum that they make on a tree. It goes bam, bam. It's like two hits in a row, and the second sounds almost like an echo of the first. And Marchand Lamertink, my colleague, actually designed this box that he puts on, lashes to a tree. It's like a resonator, and he's got like these two broomsticks with a pivot point in the middle, and he'll hit the thing hard, and the other side of it will swing over the top and hit it again a fraction of a second later, and it makes a perfect imitation of a Campephalus woodpecker double rap. And so we were doing that all over those mesas we were exploring.
You know, in the hopes of
hearing one respond. He tried it in Central America with a pale-billed woodpecker and gotten good responses, which is a relative, a smaller Campephalus species.
So you end your book fairly hopeful, talking about efforts to conserve the bird's habitat.
Yes, I mean, that's the big hope. You know, we have... Just recently, there have been things like one village threw out the drug people, and they have roadblocks, and they're well armed themselves, which is a little crazy. It's like vigilantes, but you know they're protecting their forest and everything because the drug growers, a lot of times they'll cut down the forest and they'll grow poppy plantations there and marijuana, but there's still a lot of it. I mean, I've always had a hopeful attitude about everything I do, and I did become discouraged at the end, worrying, even if we could find an imperial woodpecker nest, can we help this bird? And I don't know the answer. I think things have to improve. We have to, and Mexico has a new president, and I'm hoping, you know, he's taken a different approach. I think the original approach where America encouraged Calderon to, you know, go after these drug lords, and they took out these prominent people. And then it was kind of like whatever order had existed before became chaotic. And there was a breakdown of Law and Order, not just drug-related things, but people were stealing, raping women, you know, with impunity. Police were afraid to come out of their police stations in a lot of areas. And now in those mountains, you don't see any police or military up there. They're at the base of the mountains with blockades, but yeah.
You don't sound too optimistic to me.
I know. I'm hoping things will change.
Tim Gallagher, his book is titled Imperial Dreams, Tracking the Imperial Woodpecker Through the Wild Sierra Madre. And I hope you listen to your wife. Wives had good instincts.
They do.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Diane. It was my pleasure.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member states.